Facebook.com.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Monday, February 19th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me on this President's Day holiday as we kick off a new week here of Bang the Book Radio. I'll start things off with our Monday mailbag segment. Got a lot of good questions from our listeners out there. If you're listening live, send me over your questions at Skating Tripods. If you're not listening live, well, send them over for next week's show. I'll be doing the Monday mailbag as we go throughout here. So really looking forward to seeing what you guys want to know about. And I'll answer the questions to the best of my ability here on today's show and on future Monday shows. As far as today goes, we got some questions about money line betting, the Tampa Bay Rays, the overlay needed to bet a college basketball total system and how to apply that. Also, my preferences on bourbon. So, you know, like I said, as long as it's something that I can answer here on the show without having to talk any kind of politics or any sort of things like that, you know, I really don't want to get into anything like that here on the shows. But if it's something you want to know about, I'm happy to answer it to the best of my ability. And if it's something I don't want to answer on the show, I'll either answer you on social media or maybe answer you in DM, something like that. But again, you can send over questions to me on Twitter at Skating Tripods. Second half of today's show, Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com for our handicapping the hardwood segment. Lots of things to talk about here in college basketball. The regular season wrapping up here in a week or so for a few of these conferences, 2-3 weeks for the rest of them. Bubble watch is on as far as Selection Sunday goes for the NCAA tournament. So we'll talk about how to use that to your betting advantage. Talk about some late regular season betting angles you can consider. A team to sell high, a team to buy low. Also look ahead to some games here early on in the week, and we'll have a little bit of an announcement here for you later on during today's show. Over at bangthebook.com, lots of great stuff going on. We are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. I know there's no NBA right now, but Parker Michaels is back with his NHL picks. We'll have Doug Carson's NBA picks once again on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday when that gets going. Also over there at the website, Big Ten Watto, listener of the show, got him to do some tennis writing for us. He's become our resident tennis expert. Picked all three outright winners in the three tennis events last week. Got a new round of tennis events starting up here today and tomorrow. So head on over to bangthebook.com. Check out his preview. He's got all three events, lots of great statistics and some charts that he does that we take screenshots of and put into those articles. A fantastic start for him here. It was a 500-1 shot a couple of weeks ago that made it all the way to the Final Four. So Big Ten Watto's tennis preview is doing a great job for us over there at bangthebook.com. Make sure that you check those out. You know, money is money. If it's a market that you can beat, go out there, try to take some positions. And obviously Big Ten Watto doing a great job there with those tennis previews. So make sure you look at those. I'll have a golf preview out today, as well as golf daily fantasy picks. NASCAR coming up here this week as well. Another UFC event this weekend. So I have previews for all those. My NBA and NHL situational betting articles are both up over there at bangthebook.com. Kyle Hunter's college basketball situational article will go up tomorrow. We should have Lockie Lockerson's college basketball futures piece as well. So tons and tons of stuff over there on the written side to go along with our free pick contest, sportsbook reviews, matchup data section, betting trends, so much stuff over there at your disposal. Take advantage of all of it. You know, this time of year, there are a lot of things going on, especially once the NBA gets back going. The NBA trade deadline just passed. The NHL trade deadline is next Monday. So you're going to have some different considerations here in these different leagues. You want to make sure that you try and stay on top of the latest, and you can do that with all the content that we have over there at bangthebook.com. This and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. Use that promo code BTB and the number 25. You get a $25 free bet just for signing up. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino as well. At BetDSI, it's only a game until you bet it. So plenty of stuff to talk about here in today's Monday mailbag segment. I'm going to start with the first question that I got, or actually the most recent question that I got, today from at Rico DeGallo, which is probably one of my favorite Twitter handles that I've come across here during the Monday mailbag or with the guests that we have on the show. His question is about money line sports and says, for action in things like hockey, soccer, props, etc., where odds aren't typically the usual minus 110, do you try to win standard unit or only lay your standard unit and just take less profit if playing a favorite and come out a winner? This is a really good question because I think a lot of times you have people that are scared away from betting the money line sports maybe scared away from betting the prop market, because sometimes you do have to lay more to win your standard bet amount size. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of people tend to shy away from baseball handicapping. Could be a deterrent when it comes to the NHL betting market as well. For me, I like to keep things simple. You know, I like to do, I've talked about it before, I like to do that 3, 4, 5% of my bankroll type style. Sometimes 5, 6, 7, depending on the sport, if I feel like I've got more edges or maybe if I play a lesser volume there. But when it comes to money line betting, what I generally tend to do is if I'm playing a favorite, I'll bet whatever it takes to win my standard unit amount. You know, so if it's a $100 bet and you're laying minus 145 on a favorite, you know, I'll play 145 to win 100, something like that. I think that this is probably the best way to do it as far as I'm concerned, because one of the things that you want to make sure that you're doing day in and day out is tracking your action. You know, that's a very important thing for you to do. I was talking with somebody about this last week, and I think one of the biggest things about being, you know, a serious bettor, or even if you're a professional bettor, is being organized. You know, organization is such a big key. Anybody can handicap a game, but in terms of organizing a bankroll, in terms of, you know, reassessing what percentage of your bankroll that is on a week-to-week basis, you have to be organized. You have to keep good, solid records. And I think when it comes to something like moneyline betting, I just like to keep it consistent. You know, if I'm going to play, you know, a spread at minus 110, I'm going to play 110 to win 100, or, you know, 550 to win 500, whatever the case may be. I'm going to do the same thing when it comes to the money lines. I'm going to bet as much as I need to win that standard unit size. And if I'm playing underdogs, I'll bet whatever I need to bet to get to that standard unit size. So if I'm playing a, you know, plus 200 underdog in baseball or hockey, something like that, you know, that'll be a half unit to win one unit, something like that. I think that's the way to do it because, like I said, I mean, it allows you to have easier organization of your bankroll. It keeps things pretty standard. That's honestly the way that I like to do it. Now, certainly if I think that there's a favorite that I really, really like, if I think there's a favorite that's mispriced, you know, yeah, obviously I could maybe do a little bit more to win 1.25 units or 1.5 units, something like that. But ultimately I'm going to go off of whatever my standard unit size is and then bet accordingly from there. So if it is a minus 200 favorite in pucks or on bases, something like that, you know, I'll play the 2X to win 1X. For me, that's the way that I do it. You know, I do know that there are people that'll play one unit to win 0.9 units with a spread bet or something like that. And it's completely up to you. I mean, I don't think that there's a right way to do it or a wrong way to do it. But like I said, for organizational purposes, I think that this just makes the most sense for me. But again, I mean, if it's something that you want to do differently, if you don't like the 2.8X to win 1X or 2.4X to win 1X, something like that, I certainly understand that. So really it's a matter of preference. But for me, my preference is to, you know, do whatever it takes to win my standard unit size, whether it's a favorite or an underdog. And I think it's a really good question because, again, like I said, I think that money line sports and sometimes paying the bigger chalk can be a real deterrent for people out there, and it shouldn't be. You know, value is value wherever you find it. If you're out there and you see a Major League Baseball line that's minus 250 and based on the model that you have, it should be minus 300, or as you're looking at this game, you think to yourself, you know what, priced a little bit low, play it. You know, go ahead and play it. I know that laying minus 250, minus 225, things like that can be a little bit concerning for people. But like I said, value is value, you know, and sometimes you get that kind of value because people are hesitant to lay those big chalky prices. And, you know, I think that there are instances where you can play some money line parlays. I think, you know, in the NHL specifically, if you've got a couple of favorites that you do like and you don't want to lay that big price, you know, I don't go overboard with the money line parlays. Generally, it'll be a 2-line parlay, 3-line parlay at the absolute most, or maybe you throw in a couple of, you know, high probability multipliers, something like that. But, you know, that's something I tend to shy away from unless I feel like I've got really good value on something like that. I'll talk about it in my UFC articles from time to time because you'll have some of those big $3 favorites. You know, maybe parlay those together, limit your exposure a little bit. Instead of playing, you know, minus six, or, you know, instead of playing 600 to win 200, you put them together in a money line parlay. Maybe you get yourself something in the minus 130, minus 140, minus 150 type of range. I think there's some value in doing things like that. And you can certainly limit your risk that way. But, you know, as far as the original question goes, I'm trying to win my standard unit size. and, you know, go with it from there. So good question there from at Rico DeGaio. And again, man, love the Twitter handle. Here's a question that from at DickFace1901. That's Dick with a Y. So I'm not calling him a dickface. I'm just telling you what his Twitter handle is. A question about the Tampa Bay Rays. Asking if they're going to be in the first bid of my win totals, which yes, they are. And I'll talk about that here in a second. Says they like some over 77.5, but wanted to wait to read my article on them. And of course, this was a tweet that I got on Friday night. Now, of course, since Friday night, well, we've seen the Tampa Bay Rays do a lot of interesting things. Of course, as we know, over the summer, they traded Evan Longoria away. Well, then they DFA'd Dickerson over the weekend and traded Jake Odorizzi to the Minnesota Twins. So first and foremost, what I want to say is I'm going to delay my season win totals a couple of days here. I think I'm going to wait until Wednesday. We're going to see what happens here this week. You know, everybody's in camp now. We've got teams sort of figuring out their situations. I think I'm going to wait until Wednesday to post my American League East season win totals because, you know, I kind of got a little bit gun shy, truthfully, with what Tampa Bay did over the weekend because I had my thing all written up. What I'm doing with the season win totals is I'm writing all my information out, my case for and again, or, you know, my case for the over, for the under, looking at the transactions that these teams have made. I have not put the odds into any of them yet. I've written 13 so far, haven't put the odds into any of them yet, because I don't want myself to be biased by looking at that number over and over again and tailoring my article as a result. So I have to go back in, put in the season win total odds, and then put my pick at the bottom. And I will have a pick on all 30 teams. Again, not all of them are going to be particularly strong, but I'll let you know what the ones that are strong. So then Tampa Bay does what they did. And it's not just trading Jake Odorizzi, because I have serious concerns about Jake Odorizzi anyway. He's got what seems to be a chronic back injury. Walk rate climbed last year. The home run rate went through the roof, and I don't really see a significant regression in that with what we see league-wide and with the juiced balls. So Odorizzi is not really that big of a concern for me. But what is a concern for me is that the Tampa Bay Rays are now going to run a four-man rotation through the middle of May. Now, they'll have some Johnny Holstaff outings where they start with a bullpen guy and then just use their bullpen guys exclusively. My guess is they'll kind of try to time these around Chris Archer's starts, expecting him to, you know, be able to give them six or seven innings and kind of save the bullpen. But this four-man rotation thing is very interesting. I mean, we have seen teams do this in the past. We've seen Colorado do it here recently, where, you know, the whole object is you kind of use your starters for five innings, pull them from the game because, you know, they're going on shorter rest. Then you really put a lot of emphasis on your bullpen. And for Tampa Bay, I don't love this strategy. I understand what they're trying to do here because they have, you know, some limited starting pitching now, but I don't love their bullpen. I don't like their bullpen really at all this season. So Tampa Bay now is a team where, you know, I basically have to reevaluate, you know, what's going on here with the Tampa Bay Rays, because they're going to have this four-man rotation, and that brings a lot of uncertainty into the picture. So I need to take some time to edit this one while I'm writing, all, you know, finishing up the AL West. So that's why I'm kind of pushing these win totals back a couple of days. But for right now, I would have to say that with Tampa Bay, I'm either looking at the under or I'm not touching them at all. I don't think that there's any reason to play the over when you have this uncertainty now of a four-man rotation. You know, I still think that the offense is fairly decent, and, you know, maybe with the Dickerson move, they're trying to free up a little bit more money to go out there and get some of the free agent stragglers that are out there, and there are a lot of them. But now I kind of look at this situation, and I wonder to myself, how long is Chris Archer going to be here? Because Chris Archer is a guy with an escalating cost in arbitration, a guy who doesn't seem to be particularly happy with the direction of the organization, and I certainly can't fault him for that. And also for Tampa Bay, I mean, look, they've got some prospects that are knocking on the door. You know, they've got Willie Adames, who should be taking over for Adany Hecheverria very early in the season. I'm surprised they'd keep Hecheverria and DFA Dickerson, even though Dickerson had a bad second half last year. But I kind of wonder what Tampa Bay's direction is right now. And I don't think that direction includes Chris Archer. And Chris Archer is a guy that can net you something very significant in the trade market. And this is something you have to consider with these season win totals, is that these teams are going to be moving players. And we saw a very soft trade market last year. Rentals, you know, there was virtually no trade market for them, which is why Kansas City decided to buy instead of sell. But these cost-controlled assets, I'm surprised San Diego didn't move a guy like Brad Hand. Now they go out and sign Eric Hosmer. Well, now I know why they didn't move Brad Hand. But some of these cost-controlled assets that have more than, you know, a few months worth of shelf life on them, like a Chris Archer, you can replenish a farm system very, very quickly with a guy like that. So I'm very worried about Tampa Bay long term because I don't know what they do with Chris Archer. You know, and I'm also not sure, you know, in terms of the four-man rotation that they're looking to go with here, how does this stack up for them? I mean, I love Chris Archer. I think Chris Archer is phenomenal. I think Chris Archer's had very bad luck here when it comes to his ERA, some of his advanced metrics. But, you know, they don't have Alex Cobb. They've got Blake Snell, who's very inefficient, high pitch count type of guy. He's a five and fly type of guy to begin with. Jake Faria is a guy that I like. I think he is the type of guy that, you know, can be relatively efficient here in this type of setting. But again, you know, he's not really a proven guy. Didn't work too deep into ball games last year. You start to run down the list here a little bit. Nate Eovaldi, a guy that's never really been able to break out. Matt Andrees, again, same type of thing with him. Brent Honeywell, who I like quite a bit, but you know, how's he going to react to a four-man rotation? Does he even make the rotation out of spring training? You would think with Jake Odorizzi gone, he probably should. But you start adding up a lot of questions here about this team. Also, not just Chris Archer, does Alex Colome get traded? Because Alex Colome, easily the best relief pitcher on this team right now, he's a guy that could have some value in the trade market as well. So for Tampa Bay, lots of uncertainty. Definitely not a situation that I really want to look too heavily into for an overplay. They would be an under or a stay away here. And again, they could wind up being a surprising team. You know, they are one of those teams that tends to find a lot of inefficiencies out there in the marketplace because of the way that they have to operate. But I will not be looking to take them as an over here. And, you know, this is something why, you know, some of our competitors, and I do have a question about our competition here later in the mailbag, but some of our competitors have started releasing their team previews so far, and I'm just not comfortable with doing that yet because of the sheer number of free agents that are out there. But that being said, I can't keep pushing it back. So Wednesday will be the day the American League East will roll out. Friday, I'll put out the American League Central. The following Monday, I'll put out the American League West. We'll kind of stagger these. And as I get the National League done, I'll post them a little bit quicker together just so that they are out there. But that is my plan right now. I intend to post these over at bangthebook.com. We're also going to put them into a PDF file as more of an ebook or an e-guide. So you can have something that's offline, something that's maybe a little bit easier for you to read. I'll organize those by division. So that will be the plan for our season win totals. My goal here is to have every team up and posted by March 1st. Obviously, I know the 21st and the 23rd would be Wednesday and Friday, 26th then next Monday. So I'm hoping to have these all done by March 1st and then roll them out as quickly as possible because I've got conference tournament previews coming out for college basketball as well. So I really need to buckle down, get going at a little bit quicker of a pace with these, but I will let you know if the timelines are adjusted at all. But as far as Tampa Bay goes, to our listener at DickFace1901, right now I can't look at them from an over standpoint just because they're losing their identity. They're kind of in a transitional phase, and that four-man rotation thing really does scare me. By the way, one other thing to consider here, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, they are talking as if they're going to run with a six-man rotation. Now, we have seen teams do this in the past for a short period of time to kind of give their starters a little bit of rest, kind of extend them out a little bit. A lot of times starting pitchers don't like this. They like to get into a rhythm, into a routine, go every fifth day, know when their bullpens are going to be. Now, for Anaheim, it makes some sense because they have a lot of guys that have been injured over the last three seasons. But you know, that's another one of those sort of unknowns that, you know, we kind of got to figure out and see how we want to play those types of situations. At SecretSpy73 on Twitter, as we transition over to the college basketball side, need to pick your brain. As a rule of thumb in over-under in college basketball, aside from all other homework, what do you consider an edge as far as points you would bet? An edge of 4 points in a line, 6 points in a line, so on. So this is a really interesting question, and I hate to have a cop-out type of answer here, but I'm going to have one because it's on a case-by-case basis. Now, if I feel like I've got an edge of 4 points in a game with a total of 118, that's a lot more significant than an edge of 4 points in a game with a total of 158. So the edge is going to be relative to the total, the number of possessions, things of that sort. You know, if you're going to have a fast-paced game, an up-and-down type of game, a Youngstown State versus, you know, I don't know, Wisconsin Green Bay or something like that, Wisconsin Milwaukee, then, you know, you have a Youngstown State team that runs, and that's all they do, and they don't play very good defense. If I feel like I have a 4-point edge in one of their games, it doesn't mean nearly as much than if I have a 4-point edge in Virginia games. or, you know, some other St. Peter's, somebody like that, that plays very, very slow. So it's a hard question to answer because the edge is going to be dictated by the total, you know, the number of possessions, the expectations for that game change based on, you know, how that game is going to be played. So I think it's a really difficult question to answer. Now, you know, I know that I can talk about this question with Kyle Hunter as well, and he'll probably wind up having the same answer as I do, but you really don't want to hold necessarily to a concrete number, I guess would be the answer. Because like I said, you know, 4 points in a total of 120, a lot different than 4 points in a total of 160. So you have to keep that in mind. You have to have a sliding scale. You know, if you have an edge of 10 points in a game with a total of 120, A, there's probably something wrong with your projection. But B, I mean, that's a significant edge. If it's a total of 170, well, you know, it's not necessarily as significant of an edge. And also, too, I mean, you have to keep in mind when it comes to college basketball now at this time of the year, we've talked about this on the show, teams that aren't playing for anything, probably not a whole lot of defense. Teams that are playing for something, a lot more defense. So if you have a four-point edge in a game with a couple of bubble teams, you know, how much does that actually mean? Probably more than it would mean in a game with two teams that, you know, maybe don't play at fast paces but aren't playing for anything. So it's really a case-by-case basis, and again, I hate to have that kind of cop-out answer, but, you know, truth be told, there are a lot of questions in the handicapping industry, in the handicapping realm, where it is on a case-by-case basis. I don't know how many times I ask Brad Powers a question, and I get that answer, that it's on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, when it comes to a question like that, it's very, very difficult to answer, but you have to think about it of, you know, the greater the edge you have in a low total game, the better off you are. And then you need a really big edge in a high total game to consider, you know, that to be something that you want to pursue, something that you want to play. So again, and it comes, you know, honestly, there's a correlation as well between spreads and high totals or spreads and low totals as well. When you think about a game where, you know, it's going to be 61, 62, 63 possessions, and you've got a big favorite, you have to take that into consideration. Similarly, if it's a game that's going to have 70 possessions or 73 possessions and you've got a big favorite, that's an altogether different situation as well. So those are things that you really want to keep in mind here as you're looking at college basketball. Situationally, does the game mean anything to both teams? You know, what sort of pace do you expect the game to be played at? Because, again, think about it. If you've got a big favorite in a game with a lot of possessions and that team is that much better than the other team, on each possession, they have an advantage, and those things add up possession after possession. In a low-scoring game, a team may have a pretty big advantage. You know, maybe a team has an advantage of, you know, 0.25, 0.3, 0.4 points per possession, but it may be a 60-possession game. So those things add up a lot slower in that type of game. So it's really hard to talk about a rule-of-thumb type of edge when it comes to college basketball or really any type of sport. I mean, maybe in the NBA it makes some more sense because a lot of teams – are around the average pace. But in college basketball, the average pace is, you know, I mean, the median pace is nowhere near the highs and lows of college basketball. So it's a hard question to answer in that regard. But, you know, I think that there are a couple of important tips to keep in mind as sort of a corollary to that question. At Kez2109 says, I have a system that in an 800-plus game sample size is over 65% win percentage straight up, but not breaking 50% against the spread. What's the best way to use that edge? Well, money line, playing money lines, you know, would certainly be a way to use that edge. But in a follow-up question I asked him that, you know, I didn't include here in the Monday mailbag is that, you know, I asked if he was tracking this data. Because 65% straight up, it may not be a great thing. You know what I mean? Is it picking 95% of, you know, minus 300 or higher favorites? You know, then maybe there's some value in that. But is it picking, you know, 55% of minus 200 to minus 225 favorites? You know, that's one of those things where you do need to back test a system like that to find out, you know, where the sweet spot is. Is there an area where it is picking games at a very high probability to where you have some edges on the money line? And it's very easy to go online, find a percentage to money line converter. You can find them at pretty much any site in this industry. You know, you can look at things like a minus 200 favorite. Well, that has implied probability of 66.67%. So about two-thirds of the time a minus 200 favorite should win the game straight up. Is your system picking those at 72 or 73%? Then maybe there's some value in taking some money line prices in that minus 200 range. But you have to backtest that to find out. So until you do that, it's very hard to find an edge in that regard because, you're kind of betting blindly. I mean, a minus 400 favorite and a minus 140 favorite are two very, very different things. So you have to see what the confidence range is of that system that you're using. Now, the fact that it's not breaking 50% against the spread, I'm not really sure how to interpret that information. You know, is it, like I said, is it picking 55% of minus 125, minus 135 favorites? And it might be tough for that to be doing well against the spread. Is it picking, you know, minus 400 favorites at a 90% clip, but they're not covering the spread? You know, that's something you need to consider as well. So if you've got a system, if you've got some sort of model that you're looking to use, the most important thing I can tell you is that you have to backtest it and see where you are actually getting some edges. Because right now, 65% win percentage straight up, that's not an edge to me because I don't know where the edge is. I just don't know. So you have to backtest systems like that. That's an important thing as well, and it kind of circles back to that first question I talked about, you know, what your standard bet size would be with some of these money line plays in hockey and soccer and things of that sort. You've got to track this data. You have to track this information if you want to be serious about it. You have to be organized. You know, I know that it's hard to do that if you've got a standard 9-to-5 and you're capping the card from 5-to-7 and putting your plays in, you know, at the last minute. But, you know, you have to have this data in front of you to confirm whether or not it's actually an edge. So without that, it's a very hard question to answer, but I think it's a good learning point for our listeners that are out there. At Bets by Bob says, just listen to your MLB podcast, and I must know, what are the bourbon preferences the moment? Well, I'm just going to sort of group them into bourbon and whiskey here because I don't necessarily want to pick nits on today's show, and you know, I got some other questions to answer in the mailbag. But I'll say this. As far as the really popular brands go, the Crown, the Jack, the Jameson, things of that sort, I'm at the point now where you know I have to mix those. You know, whether it's Jack and Ginger, Jameson and Ginger, Jack and Coke. Crown is my favorite mixer with Coke, for those that care. I got to mix those. But when we start talking about single barrels, Bullet, Four Roses, Woodford, you know, some of the better ones that are out there, you know, those are the ones that you can drink straight. So I've gotten on a Four Roses kick here lately. That's a very, very good, very affordable type of bourbon. I think if you're going to go with the Jameson route, the Caskmates is pretty good. Jack Single Barrel is pretty good. Bourbon 10 or a Bullet 10 year. I think Bullet has a 12 year now as well that I haven't had a chance to try yet, but you know, bourbon is definitely the one for me. I'm not big on the light liquors like vodka, gin, white rum. I like dark rum, but I don't really do the white rum kind of thing. But as far as bourbon goes, you know, Crown and Coke would be my, you know, I'm just looking to relax a little bit. If I'm really looking to relax, I'm going with Bullet 10 year or Four Roses or the Jack Single Barrel. So you know, those are the ones for me. I know that there are a lot of people that are out there doing, you know, like the Evan Williams type stuff, maybe the Black Velvet type stuff. And I had those days, but you know, I've kind of refined almost at the same time, both my beer palate and my bourbon palate. So I'm kind of going a little bit more expensive with the bourbons, a little bit more expensive with the beers. And that's the nice thing about, you know, being an adult and having some disposable income is, you know, your drink preferences should certainly rise on a pretty, you know, pretty straight path. So, you know, for me, I think, like I said, I think Four Roses is one. If you want to look to get some bourbons here while we're still dealing with the winter and all that, I think Four Roses is one that I've recently had, you know, that I certainly do like quite a bit, and that's one that I would add to the list. So I had that question last week from @10jet67 about hedging and, you know, understanding the value of that. And I know that Friday's show was kind of a little bit disjointed. I was ready to fly solo, then had some guests that kind of chimed in here and helped me out a little bit with the show. But I hope I did a good job of explaining the hedging thing. In that, like I said, you've got this initial position, then there are two ways to look at it. If you've got, you know, $10 on Middle Tennessee State at 500-1, you can win $5,000. You start hedging into that right away. It becomes, you know, maybe $210 to win $5,000 if they advance, or 10 to win, you know, whatever you bet, take that away from your win amount. That's how you start hedging. So, you know, I like to have a lot of positions like this, and this is something I've really tried to focus on this year, is having more of a diversified portfolio when it comes to the futures. Because like I said, I think as I look through this on a day-by-day basis, I just see a lot more high variance environment. Obviously college basketball this year certainly stands out in that regard where everybody's kind of beating everybody, but single games have such an inherently high variance that I think if you look at some more of these futures positions, and I'll probably do this more with my MLB season win totals this year as well, take a few more of those positions on some that, you know, maybe I don't feel as strongly about, but still feel stronger about than playing on a game-by-game basis. So I think futures value is just, it's so great. I know it's really hard to tie up your money for multiple months. I think one thing I really liked about Sports Cheetah is that he talked about having two separate bankrolls, one for the futures, one for the day-to-day betting. If you can allocate in that manner, again, stay organized with it. I think that's really the way to go, because I think futures, certainly have the most opportunity for you. A couple of questions here from @MikeyDFS on Twitter, one of our favorite listeners, and it was somebody that's been a very loyal listener throughout the years, and I certainly appreciate that. Got a couple of questions here from him. The first one, competition is a good thing, and would like to hear your thoughts about your competitors and about how much this industry has grown in the last 5 years. I've said this before, when I have guests on the show, I really don't have any issue promoting their work. If it's something I believe in, something I think I can stand by, and something I think I can direct you towards, because I've had the question here lately about why I don't talk about more of my picks on the show, or why I don't take some more of those positions, because I don't want to, because my entire goal for this show has always been to try and give you the tools for success. I don't want my plays to influence anything that you think about. Yes, I have some handicappers on the show, and we give out some free picks, and those guys are professionals. I'm not a professional bettor. I'm a professional radio show host and writer. I'm not a professional bettor. And I've told you this before that, for me, if I lose some bets, if I go on a bad run, it doesn't change my lifestyle, because I don't live off of my betting bankroll. So, that's why I don't really talk too much about, the plays that I make personally or things like that. But I will stand by, some of the things that some of our guests have going for them. There are some very good competitors out there, some people that are churning out some very, very good stuff. And I think that, say what you will about the Twitter gambling community, and say what you will about some of the watchdogs that are out there and the way that they conduct themselves, but they have, in a way, sort of forced some of these sites and some of these touts that are out there to have a little bit more accountability. And I think that's a very good thing. That's something that I have seen transition throughout the industry. I like to think that maybe our show has had something to do with that as well, but this industry has grown in a really positive way. I think the public is smarter than it has been in the past. And I think the people writing about some of these concepts and some of these topics are smarter than we've had in the past. A lot of times it's been, the old school, the old guard type of handicapper that does, a lot of things that maybe worked in the past but don't work so much now. You have a lot more people out there that are writing about this industry that, are plugged into analytics, are modelers, are plugged into some of the advanced metrics and different statistics. And I think all of that stuff really does help create a more informed betting public. And I also think that, with the way that Twitter has grown, that social media presence of getting news right here, right now, I think that's stuff that has all helped. And you've had a lot of people as well that have created some very good databases to help out with looking up statistical trends or certain matchup data, or just the rise of analytics in general, I think has been a really big help to this industry, because it's encouraged people to look for edges in non-traditional ways. And for somebody that likes to do that, especially on the baseball side, it's something that's really, really good for me. And also, you just start creating a smarter betting populace with some of the stuff that our competitors are putting out there. And of course, with the stuff that we're putting out there as well. So, I think that we have, I think another thing too, is that with social media, with people having to stand by what they say, with people having to stand by what they do, it's kind of weeded out some of the pretenders here in this industry. Some of the people that, maybe don't have the strongest profiles. And then you get some of these people, and I'll talk about some that I've had on the show, like a Whale Capper, like a Colin Wilson, like Sports Cheetah, who wasn't always, with Wager Talk. I mean, he was doing a lot of this stuff, just posting it on his own, being a very sharp, very smart handicapper. With the guests that I have here on the show that I stand by, we've had some new blood in the industry, not just on the selling side, but also on the writing and reporting and researching sides. And that stuff is very, very important to me. And I think that, all of us have kind of collectively, even though we're out there fighting for clicks, fighting for our share of the market, we're making the market smarter. And I love that, and also by proxy, we've made the odds makers smarter, because they're using some of these advanced metrics in the way that they're putting together lines. And, there are different tracking systems that are out there now for them to monitor wagers and follow along with certain clients and all that type of thing. I think everything in the industry has gotten better. And that's why I think the edges in single game betting, have gotten smaller. Why I focus on derivatives and live betting and futures. But, competition is a good thing. And, you know, for me, it challenges me to be better. It challenges, you know, me to look for different edges. It challenges me to take different approaches with a lot of things. And I think all of that is very important. So competition is definitely a good thing. I applaud what a lot of our competitors out there are doing. I certainly love what we're doing here at bangthebook.com. And like I said, you know, I mean, I'm not going to be some petty, you know, catty type of person. If I see something out there that I think has value for our listeners, whether it's a competitor, whether it's, you know, something that I use in my season win total, something like that, I'm certainly going to share it, because I think that, you know, it only hurts my people, my listeners, my readers, when I don't pass along something that I think has value. So, you know, I have no problem promoting the stuff that other people do, as long as I think it, you know, falls in line with the mission statement that I've had for this show. And I think in a lot of instances, I have done a pretty good job of passing that along. And, you know, I think too, like I said, I mean, just the natural watchdoggedness, watchdoggery, I'll just make up words here, of this industry is something I think has helped, you know, really grow it in the last 5 years. One more question here from at Mikey DFS, asking about the 1% fee that the leagues want. Says, with the leagues and government wanting a big piece of the pie, will we have minus 115 or higher VIG? Could be a case to be careful what you wish for. Now, I wrote a piece a few weeks ago when this integrity fee was first discussed openly in the public forum over at bangthebook.com. I believe the title is, you know, progress being made, but at what cost? And I talk about things of this sort. And this is something I've talked about with Brian Leonard before. So I've talked about with another friend of mine who works for William Hill Sportsbooks, in that, you know, what does the ultimate framework of this look like? Now, the leagues are not getting their 1%. When you think about the hold percentage for the books on the total handle, it's anywhere between 4 and 6%. They are not getting 20 to 25% of the hold for the sportsbooks. So the 1% integrity fee is not going to happen. You know, the leagues realistically don't deserve anything out of this, because it's betting and gambling and daily fantasy that, you know, enhances the viewership and the reach of their product. So they're getting that part of it. They don't need this integrity fee. If the sportsbooks and the operators do fold to these demands, though, it won't be 1%. It may be a quarter of a percent. Half of a percent is even asking a whole lot. I mean, that's still 10% of the pie, 10 to 12.5% of the pie. Maybe they get a percentage, you know, 0.2%, 0.1%, something like that. The books do have to make up for that gap, and it probably will be a higher VIG. It probably will be minus 115 instead of minus 110. Maybe minus 120 even. And, you know, we see this on a local level. A lot of locals, the bookies that, you know, operate in out of bars and bowling alleys and things like that sort, they have higher VIG. And people pay it because they don't care. And the astute bettors that do care will continue to play offshore, or will find opportunities for themselves to play the lower VIGs. Other people just don't care. You know, and you see that when it comes to people that play a lot of parlays. I mean, you know, I'm guilty of playing lottery tickets as well, but there are a lot of people that swear by them, and you're paying a pretty high edge when it comes to a parlay. You're not getting the true payout odds by any means, and more often than not, you're going to lose, and lose badly. And, you know, those are the types of people that, you know, widespread legalization will probably cater to, and they don't care about the minus 115. It doesn't mean anything to them. They don't think of it as, well, if I'm a $100 better, I have to bet 115 instead of 110. What's $5? I don't care. It doesn't matter. You know, from a break-even percentage, as we know, you're talking about a much higher break-even percentage at minus 115. You're in the 53% range instead of the 52.4% range. A lot of people aren't going to care. They're just going to be happy to have access to their money, be betting in a regulated format. So minus 115 won't matter to them. The operators may do this anyway in some of these states. It certainly is a possibility, because you're going to have less competition. If this is legalized in Pennsylvania or New York or, you know, Indiana or West Virginia or wherever else, so I think of West Virginia, until they get this thing operating in bars and have the kiosks, you know, there's Mountaineer, there's Wheeling, there's a few horse tracks. There's not a whole lot of competition. So if you're an operator, and it'd probably be a single operator state, you got minus 115, who's going to call you on it? Who's going to challenge you on it? You don't have to worry about it. You know, and that begs another question. Will this be a state, you know, a state set law of minus 115? Will the operators have free reign? Will some operator with deeper pockets come in and say, you know, we're going to do minus 112 while they do minus 115 or minus 120. You know, we're going to take advantage of that. I don't know. It is a complete discussion that I could use an entire show about, but I think the 1% fee is ludicrous. Like, the league should be happy with what betting and DFS do for them to begin with. And there is no way in hell the operators will accept losing 20 to 25% of the handle. And just think about the Super Bowl. Think if there was a 1% integrity fee on the Super Bowl. The books in Nevada had a very, very low hold, barely in the seven figures. If there's a 1% fee, that is a dramatic, substantial loss for them. And that's something they have to keep in mind. That is absolutely something you have to keep in mind is, you know, yeah, we generally win year after year after year, but we've got a low hold percentage anyway. We've got a small margin. We can't give up 1%. So that's not going to happen. I don't know what kind of impasse that will create with the legislation, but yeah, I mean, I would certainly expect, to be completely honest with you, a lot of states going higher than the minus 110 vig. I think we'll be more like minus 115 and maybe even in some states, minus 120, especially if the operators have to compromise to some sort of fee or some sort of high taxes in that state. So a lot of good Monday mailbag questions here for today's show. Please reach out to me on Twitter at Skating Tripod. Send them over. Happy to answer anything that you want to know about here on future editions of the Monday Mailbag. One guest here for today's show. This is our Handicapping the Hardwood segment with Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
Going all right. How about yourself, Adam?
I'm doing well, man. Good to hear from you here on this Monday afternoon. Lots of things for us to talk about here on today's show. And the first thing I want to ask you about, this is actually a continuation of last week's Monday Mailbag. Had a listener question sort of wondering about how I myself and also my guests got their starts in the sports betting industry. So what was it for you? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, for me, it was actually a second job at the time to start writing articles for multiple websites. And one of the websites that I wrote articles for actually offered me a position after my articles and the free picks that I was doing were doing really well. And I ended up being offered the position to be a handicapper. And at the time, you know, I wasn't sure if I really wanted to do it or not, and ended up doing it, and it ended up working out the first year that I handicapped publicly and had my records tracked. You know, did amazing. That was a really good kickoff to my career, and you know that really just kind of kicked things off really well. You know, I was doing this on my own, just kind of on the side, you know, for many years to start with, and then started writing the articles and kind of had that as a second job from home, and then it turned into a full-time thing, and you know, that's how it began about 10 years ago now.
Well, and it's interesting the way that our relationship began, because we didn't know each other until pretty much right before we started doing the College Football Podcast. And I was sort of looking around. For those that don't know, bangthebook.com used to have a sister website, but that's not really what it was, BTV Cappers. And I found Kyle on there, and, you know, I was looking for somebody to do a College Football Podcast with, and, you know, wanted to keep it in-house and pick somebody that was, you know, working for the site, either in a writing capacity or on the sales side of things. And you know, you and I started this thing, I mean, in August, it's going to be, 5 years ago that we started this, back in August of 2013, doing 45-minute college football podcast each week, and now it's blossomed into this, and obviously, you know, you and I are friends off the air as well. But, you know, it's kind of amazing the way that so many people have so many interesting stories and so many paths that they took to this industry.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's going to be 5 years coming up soon. You know, time can really fly. You know, I think that, you know, for me, it was, you know, not necessarily something that, you know, I had my mind on that I was going to do. You know, I had my normal 9-to-5 job, and I started doing work from home on the side. And, you know, then I kind of finally realized, hey, I really like this. You know, I think I'm going to like this better than my normal job. And, you know, I started doing well for myself. And so then, you know, that turned into my career. It wasn't really the goal. I, you know, wouldn't have set, you know, 15 years ago that this is what I was going to do necessarily, but that's the way it ended up going. And, you know, there's some things I don't like about this job. There's some things I do like a lot about this job. And you know, I'd always, you know, I like that I'm able to work in something that I'm passionate about. You know, I like that there's, you know, not too many people get the opportunity to, you know, do something that they really like or you know, kind of their top hobby is also what they're able to work in. And so, you know, I'm able to do that. I'm able to, you know, build some relationships with people like yourself and then, you know, just be able to, you know, spend time in something that I really enjoy. So, you know, I've been fortunate in that capacity.
And I think Kyle's story is really good for our listeners out there, because I know that a lot of our listeners have been with us for the long haul. They're very passionate about this as well. But I know a lot of them working 9-to-5s. I mean, you got a college degree, you were working in the corporate world, and then just decided, you know what, I'm pretty good at this. This is what I want to do. And then started dedicating the obscene amount of time that you do to doing this. But for our listeners out there that, maybe have that 9-to-5, but have a burning passion, for this industry. I mean, don't get me wrong. Kyle and I will both tell you probably almost simultaneously here that it is not easy. It is not easy to be a long-term winner. Sometimes, the customer service side of things can be pretty challenging. But if you are somebody out there that is serious about this, find a way to do some writing for somebody. We're always looking for writers at bangthebook.com. That's how Kyle got his start, doing some writing, doing some free pick stuff, studying it a little bit more, understanding the market some more. It's been kind of a step-by-step, longer-term process for you, but I know that you wouldn't trade it for anything at this point.
Yeah, right. And I think that, starting out as a writer is a really good way to do it, because if you start out as a writer and people start reading your stuff and realize that, this guy, I think he has an edge. He's finding something that not too many other people are finding. Word's going to get out about that, and, that'll help you out to, whatever you want to do in the industry. It's certainly a good way to start out. And, I would echo what you said that, if you want to be in this industry full time, certainly you really have to love what you do. I mean, there are a ridiculous amount of hours that can be spent. There's not the days off. That's certainly one of the big negatives from my standpoint, is not having those days off and not being able to just call in and take a vacation and things like that. But it's kind of the trade-off for being able to work in something that you really enjoy that much. So that's the way I would put it.
All right. I think it's been really interesting to hear the different stories from our guests here on the show. And I appreciate the question we had about that. Again, that was from at 10Jet67. So I got that question last week, but I know that we had a full slate of things to talk about already. So I figured I would use it here this week. And, again, for our listeners that ever have any questions for the Monday Mailbag, whether it's for me or for our guests here, shoot them over to me on Twitter at Skating Tripods. Kyle, it's February 19th, and, for me, I'm big into baseball mode here already. Spring training games, I think, start Friday, maybe, with inter-squad games and stuff like that. So that's coming up very quickly, but it also means March Madness is right around the corner. Everyone's talking bracketology. So one of the top points that we want to talk about here on today's show is the bubble, and that bubble watch is in full effect right now.
Yeah, you're going to be hearing a lot about the bubble here coming up. And I know I've even gotten questions here in the last week. What do I do with from clients? What do I do with bubble teams? I'm interested in backing bubble teams because they need to win these games. I'm not necessarily saying you should just go against bubble teams, but a word of caution is that everybody knows that these bubble teams have to win, and including the books. And these teams that have to win don't always win. We see these spots where, these teams that have a lot of pressure on them just don't come through in the pressure. We see this in every sport. The NFL, you can get those must-win games, and you have to pay a significant price for those, and sometimes it's not worth the price. And I just wanted to say that because I think that, I don't have any specific number or anything on a bubble team. That'd be really hard to there's no real data that you could find on a team that was quote-unquote on the bubble. But I will say I think that you'll probably end up behind in the long term if you're taking just bubble teams that have to win blindly, if for no other reason than just for losing the juice. You're not going to be getting enough value on the number. At this point in the season, that's what everybody's talking about is the bubble watch and, who's going to make the big dance and who needs to do what in order to get there. Remember that these are college kids that, they can be really inconsistent. And, those teams that really have a lot to play for sometimes don't look like it. And it might not be because they're not trying. It might just because they're not executing properly. So, just kind of a word of caution from me is that in that bubble watch, it gets a lot of publicity. And I think that creates a situation where it's hard to find value on that team.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would tend to shy away from bubble teams that are favorites, because you've got that must-win type of thing. You have that expectation, and what also happens then is that, they're favored to win, so they're supposed to win, right? So it's a must-win game that they're supposed to win, And then the number gets inflated a little bit. And it may not be a lot. It may be a point. It may be a point and a half. It may be market driven. It may not even be incorporated by the odds makers. But the fact remains that, you know, now you have this team that has expectations, has to live up to them. And by the way, they're on the bubble, which means they're probably not that good anyway. So you're just adding additional expectations to a team that could very easily fall short of them. I think what I would rather do in terms of the bubble teams is I would look for the ones that are underdogs, the teams that, you know, probably aren't expected to win the game, but need a good showing. They're a little bit motivated. Also, you know, maybe you walk into a situation where the other team isn't quite as motivated, but, you know, that inflation on that number for the must win type of game, you don't see that as much in an underdog capacity because, you know, it's just kind of harder to incorporate that into the line. So I think, you know, when you've got a team that's in a spot where they need an impressive performance, where they need to do something that kind of stands out and they're an underdog, I think there are a couple that we could kind of point to here a little bit on today's show. You know, Penn State, for example, with that big blowout win over Ohio State, Ohio State was supposed to win that game. It meant a lot more to Penn State. Penn State got the regular season sweep, but they're a team that has now played itself onto the bubble. That wasn't a must-win game because they weren't really in a must-win mode anyway. If they lose that game, then, you know, they're pretty much in the same position that they were. Because they won that game, they moved their stock up a little bit. Providence is another one. Providence is a team that, you know, kind of sitting there in that bubble discussion. I know you and I were following along with that Villanova game closely because each one of us has a piece of them. And, you know, that was not a game that they were supposed to win. It was not a must-win game. It's a good win for them. It's a great win for them. But it wasn't that must-win type of feel, but they were an underdog in a situation where it made sense to go after them. I think that's where you want to use the bubble to your advantage.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, you know, you start laying points, you're going to be laying, you know, 7 points instead of 5 or 5.5 points. And, you know, I probably don't have to tell bettors who are listening to this show that, you know, a lot of games finish in that half a point, 1 point, 1.5 points off what you lay in that spot or even what you take. I mean, there are a lot of close games come right down to the wire. So just laying, you know, it doesn't sound like that much. You know, say, oh, man, 1 point, 1.5 points difference. I think that's a mistake to say, oh, well, you know, don't worry about that 1 or 1.5 points because we should all know by now that there are a lot of games that come down to that very last possession, the very last shot. I agree with you. I think that grabbing points as an underdog against a team that they're not necessarily supposed to beat, but maybe they have more to play for than that other team. That other team's already in the tournament and they're just that good. I think that that's a better situation to take a bubble team.
And again, I mean, use this stuff to your advantage. You know, you've got bracketology. I mean, I'm looking at the list right now, the last four buys, last four in, first four out, next four out from Joe Lunardi. And, you know, every site has this type of thing where, I mean, March Madness, it's huge. I mean, it captivates the entire, not just sports betting industry, but sports industry, you know, for the first 4 days. And then obviously once you get into that second weekend, it just, it takes precedence almost over almost everything else. And so when you have a situation like that, everyone's talking about these bubble teams. Everyone's talking about these teams that, you know, oh, they're in this situation. Oh, they're in that situation. Again, you can use that to your advantage because as we've talked about, there are a lot of people that are just now getting into college basketball over the last 2 weeks or so. They're going to hear, oh, this team needs to win this game. Okay, I'm going to play that team. But you know, because you've been following along, yeah, that team's probably not very good, at least certainly not good enough to have increased expectations. So maybe you wait that game out, play back on the other side, close to tip off, something like that. You know, use these narratives, these media-driven narratives to your advantage.
Right, and I think I would say that, you know, the bubble is not that strong this year. You know, there's so much parity that, you know, there's teams there that are plenty good enough to win in one game, but they're not consistent enough, and that's kind of why they're on the bubble. So, you know, there's nobody at the top that's really dominant, but a lot of those bubble teams have quite a few flaws as well. You know, I think that it's just something to keep in mind that these bubble teams are bubble teams for a reason. You know, they if they had been really good throughout the course of the season and been really consistent, they would have been higher than that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, I'll just use one team as an example here, and then we'll go ahead and move on from this topic. But you look at a team like St. Bonaventure, for example, they get that big home win over Rhode Island. Right now, they've played themselves onto the bubble. Looks like Joe Lunardi's got them as a last four in one of those play-in games. You know, this is a team that has four losses in conference play, one on the road at Rhode Island, one on the road at Davidson, one on the road at St. Joe's, one on the road at Dayton. You know, they still have to go play VCU on the road, St. Louis in the regular season finale. You know, they can maybe make up some ground in the conference tournament because they should run into Rhode Island at the end when it's all said and done. But still, I mean, St. Bonaventure is a team that's played itself onto the bubble, has lost four games, three that maybe it shouldn't have as a bubble team. You know, now you put expectations on them. Yeah, they're playing really well. Yeah, they're blowing out some bad teams in the A-10. But still, you know, this is a team that now has expectations on it to the point where people remember, oh, hey, they just beat Rhode Island. Oh, hey, Joe Lunardi has them in the tournament. They're priced against Duquesne on Wednesday, probably going to be inflated a little bit. Is that a situation you want to back? I would say no.
I'd be worried to back a situation like that. You know, St. Bonaventure specifically is a team that has a star in Jalen Adams. But, you know, the rest of the team around him isn't necessarily always very good. And, you know, being so reliant on one player can be pretty difficult.
Sounds like another team that's in action tonight who may wind up playing itself out of the bubble is Oklahoma. And we talked about them last week with Brad Powers and about, you know, that's another thing, too, is you know, these networks want to drum up interest in March Madness. I mean, March Madness does kind of sell itself. When you talk about a team like Oklahoma and Trae Young, I mean, everyone knows the name Trae Young. If you follow college basketball at all, you know Trae Young. And what we talked about with Brad Powers last week is, you know, he was saying, look, Trae Young is a great player. I mean, he's scoring 29 points per game. But what he does to Oklahoma in the eyes of the betting market, you know, people think Oklahoma is a much better team than they are. I mean, this is already a 10-loss team below 500 in Big 10 play or Big 12 play. They're a 6th seed right now per Lunardi, but you know, they're kind of going in the wrong direction here. But people think Trae Young, Oklahoma's awesome. They've got the best player in the country. The supporting cast is not very good. So if you've got those teams that are, you know, one player dominant here, you may hear about them over and over again on ESPN and CBS Sports and Fox Sports 1 and all that. But all that does is obscure the fact that it's a very flawed team behind that player. And this is a time of year, too, when you can play up on some of those things because networks are trying to sell individual players on individual teams.
I'm really glad you brought up Oklahoma. In fact, it was one that I was thinking about bringing up myself. You know, I sit there and look at Oklahoma's profile and I say, are we sure they're in the tournament? Because, I mean, they've lost a lot of games in a row here. They have some good wins in the non-conference, you know, at Wichita State, that win over UF, pretty good win. Obviously, Oklahoma was playing really well earlier this year. But, you know, they're 16-10. Now they play at Kansas. They also play at Baylor. They flip up in one of those home games and lose three of their last four. They're going to be right on the bubble. You know, this is an Oklahoma team that it wouldn't stun me if they missed the tournament, if they completely fall apart here, because they've played really poorly of late. You know, I don't want to get on my soapbox too much, but I don't really like the way that Trae Young has been, you know, talked up by ESPN and then they kind of talk him down by the way he's played lately. This guy's a freshman. He's really good. He's a very good player. But as you said, because they've talked about him so much and everybody knows Trae Young, there's not as much value on this Oklahoma team as there should be, even, you know, with their record and the way that the team is overall. I think they were laying, you know, 6.5 points or something like that at home against Texas. I wish I had taken Texas in that one. But, you know, that's a number that was inflated because of the Trae Young factor right there.
All right, so as we're sort of wrapping up the regular season here in some of these conferences, as I mentioned, I think St. Bonaventure's got four games left. There are some teams that have fewer than that because they have earlier conference tournaments, the Big Ten being one of them here this year. They have a very early conference tournament relative to when it usually is because it's not in Indianapolis anymore. So this is a really good time of the year to start talking about some of those late regular season betting strategies. I know we've touched on some of them here a little bit already. You're going to take a statistical look. I'll take a little bit, you know, more of a situational look here once we get through some of these numbers. But you know, what are some things that you've kind of been looking at here lately?
Well, you know, I ran a few queries on this one to see, you know, kind of verify that this was the way that I expected it to be. This is the time of the year that, you know, the last couple games of the season, you want to look to lay points more often than you want to look to grab the underdog in general, especially when you're taking a team that hasn't done that great ATS so far for the season. So, you know, once you get a team, you say you have a team 20-8 ATS or something like that. As we've talked about before, the books have to try to catch up. It's going to be hard for them to keep covering those numbers. So I'd be hesitant to lay the points with them. But if you just look at it, game number 28 or later of the season, so their 28th game of the season or later, favorites of 4 points or larger are cashing at 54.2% ATS since 2008-2009 season. I really think that this is a case of opponent likely mailing it in. You know, there are a lot of teams that, like Adam and I have talked about here in the past, that these last couple games of the regular season don't mean much at all to them because they're not going to make the big dance unless they make a run in the conference tournament. So I think that's why these favorites of 4 points or larger are cashing at such a good rate. And if you just look at favorites in general, they're also cashing pretty well. I think it's 52.5% ATS. But interestingly, favorites of 4 points or larger, 54.2%. Maybe that's a statistical anomaly. That is a large sample size since 2008-2009 season. So I think it's certainly something to keep an eye on. And then if you just add one filter of team laying 4 points or more that has covered 55% or less of their games on the season, so 55% ATS or less, that ATS win percentage in those last couple games goes up to 56.7% since 2008-2009 season. So I think that's a pretty impressive number, and I really do think it speaks to the other team that's just kind of done with the regular season.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go, and we've talked about this a little bit, but now we can actually put some application to it, and I like those two statistics that you gave out there about how well favorites of four or more are doing in these situations, because as you mentioned, you know, the opponent, look, if you're in a mid-major type of conference, or especially a low-major conference, you have one path to the NCAA tournament, and that is to win your conference tournament. So these last regular season games, they don't mean much for you. I mean, in a lot of these conferences, everybody makes the conference tournament, or, you know, I think it's like usually the top 10 of 14 or top 12 of 16 or whatever. It's very hard to miss the conference tournament when you're in a lot of these leagues. So, you know, for them, it's about gearing up for that conference tournament. Coaches may be experimenting a little bit, trying to figure out some things that, you know, work. And then also another thing here is that in a general sense, I mean, obviously this isn't, you know, a blind statement that I'm making here, but in a general sense, if you're favored at this time of the year, you're the home team, and teams are playing, you know, some grueling travel schedules. If you're a young team, you know, you're going from regional high school basketball to traveling all over your conference. It's tiring. You know, there's a lot going on here. You know, you're in a pretty tough part of the semester or of the term or the quarter or whatever, because you've got, you know, you're right before spring break. So you got some midterms and things of that sort going on. You're kind of looking ahead to postseason play, whether you're going to March Madness or the NIT, CBI, CIT. I think they did away with the Vegas 16 now. But, you know, still, you have a lot of teams that are playing road games late in the year, kind of road weary, a little bit tired, a little bit fatigued. You know, that's another factor in here as well. And especially if you're an opponent not playing for anything and you're going on the road and you're not really all that invested, yeah, it's very tough for you to cover.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good point that, you know, even that road weary thought, you know, there's a lot of these kids that are ready to be done, you know, with the whole travel schedule. You know, it's a little bit hard throughout the course of the season in general. And then if you have a little bit less reason to be up for that game, it would be easy to mail it in, you know, and as these are not pros. It makes sense to me that laying points in the last couple games of the season is better than grabbing the points. Now, I think that, you know, one thing, as we pointed out earlier in the show, is you got to be careful, you know, just blindly laying points, because you got to know what the situation is. And that's where, you know, handicapping the game and trying to pay close attention to, you know, what does that team have to play for? What does the other team have to play for? I think more than anything else, you know, when laying points at the end of the season, I think you want to be going against teams that don't have anything to play for more than you want to be backing teams that do have something to play for, because I think it's more likely that somebody will just mail it in those last couple games of the season. I did want to also say that with over-unders, overs have more value when teams have little to play for, and the under has more value when both teams have something to play for. If you just put in one filter and say the home team has won 50% or less of their games, and then they're playing their last couple games, that makes the over at 53%. So if you get two teams who are both under that, it goes up to about 54% on the over. So it makes sense to me also that the over has more value late in the season when that game doesn't mean anything, because, you know, if that game doesn't really mean anything to you, you still want to get your points. You know, a lot of kids still want to get their 10, 12 points a game. Maybe they want to up their scoring average. But defensively, you're not going to put as much into that game. Where flip side, you know, if both of these teams have a lot to play for, this is one of those spots where the under can add more value because, say, you're playing for a regular season conference title or something, and it's two teams who could both win that conference title, I think the under has quite a bit more value in a spot like that.
Now, I completely agree with the totals point. That's something we kind of talked about with Brian Blessing on Friday's show as well with regards to the NHL and how, you know, we're seeing some very wide open games featuring teams that don't really have much to play for. You know, one other point I thought about while you were talking there in terms of the favorites and the underdogs and late season and all that type of thing is that, you know, also here, now that we're this late into the season, you probably have some teams that are drowning out their coaches. And basketball is, you know, more of an individual type of sport than football. I mean, obviously there are, you know, team sets and set plays and things of that sort. But in football, you know, if one guy screws up on the offensive line, maybe the running back picks up that pass rusher or the quarterback, you know, someone calls out to the quarterback to move around. You know, if someone's not playing defense or something like that, or someone's mailing it in basketball, it's a lot more noticeable. And if a coach has lost his players, you know, I think that has a little bit more of an impact in basketball than it does in football, because when you think about it, there are what, 39 bowl games, I think. So 78 of the 130 college football teams get to go to a bowl game. And for March Madness, 68 of the 351 college basketball teams get to go to March Madness. And, you know, maybe they get excited about the CBI or the CIT or whatever. Sometimes athletic departments don't even go because it's too, you know, it's there's no cost benefit to the school. So, you know, teams may have earned a right to go there, but then don't even get to go. You know, so I think even that late in the season, you know, paying attention to the coaches, being invested in practice, you know, I think that's even a different type of dynamic in college basketball that, you know, maybe is something that we need to try to find a way to look into a little bit more of, you know, are there teams out there where the coaches have just completely lost them? And that's where social media comes into play and access to beat writers and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked in the past about reasons why you should be following beat writers and listening to press conferences and things like that. And that's another reason why, because it is a little bit, you know, easier to tell with some teams than it is with other teams, you know, who seems to just be ready to be done with this. You know, it's hard to quantify something like that, but you know that that's a little bit of an extra edge that, you know, it just takes a lot of small edges, you know, little edges here, little edges there, to add up to a nice profit in the long run.
And to circle back to Oklahoma, and then we'll move on from this point, you know, for Oklahoma here, I mean, this team is Trae Young and everybody else. And you kind of wonder, I mean, yeah, they're a team, and guys will probably say the right things in front of the media for the most part, but Trae Young gets so much attention. And he's such a high usage player. And, you know, are some of these guys tired of playing with him? You know, or is Trae Young, you know, kind of not as coachable as he was early on in the year because he's just looking to pad his numbers? I mean, this is just speculation on my part where I'm using Oklahoma as an example. I don't know the actual dynamics, you know, of this particular team, but, you know, that's a thing too. I mean, you know, in football, it is more of a concerted group effort type of thing where, yeah, you've got the skill position guys that stand out. But, you know, if you're an offensive lineman, scouts are still looking at you. Defensive lineman, the same thing. You know, for college basketball, I mean, you know, we prop these kids up. And as you mentioned with Trae Young, you know, everyone loves him. He has a bad performance. Everyone hates him. You know, for the guys on that roster, you know, no one talks about us. No one talks about anything other than Trae Young. You know, it creates a lot of interesting dynamics. And maybe that has something to do with why Oklahoma's in such a free fall mode. Maybe it has something to do with why some of these other teams in the past have been in free fall mode. I just think that the psychology of a team is so important to handicap at this time of the year.
Yeah, I think so too. I think Oklahoma is a team that would be really hard to back right now. You know, you want to see something from them before you take them. I think that's one of those spots where you just lay off. You know, tonight, my number is a little bit smaller than that number that's out there in the market with Kansas against Oklahoma. You know, maybe a slight lean to Oklahoma, but there's no way I'm taking that one. You know, I'd rather sit that one out and look for better spots because I think that there are way too much unknown. I think it's certainly possible that Oklahoma, the rest of the roster, would be, you know, a little bit tired of the way the season has gone and, you know, the way the coverage has gone, and it might maybe hard for Trae Young as well. You know, you think of him, you know, he's, you know, getting pretty frustrated at the amount of double teams that he sees and things like that. And he's even mentioned that at press conferences. So I think that's a team that's easy to stay away from right now.
All right, we like to do a buy low and a sell high here We try to do a buy low and a sell high on every Handicapping the Hardwood segment that we do. You've got a team that you're looking to sell high here this week, and I think this one makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I'll say before I start that, you know, I try to talk about good calls and bad calls. One of the bad calls I had recently was Florida. You know, I thought Florida was going to be a team that would finish the season strong. Now Florida's going to play themselves onto the bubble. I'm really surprised that they played so poorly. Obviously, it's going to happen. You're going to have some good calls and bad calls. But, you know, since I talk about some of the ones that I've had good calls on, I wanted to point that one out as well. Let's see if we can have a couple where we find some value here this week. Sell high UCF. Three straight ATS covers. Team isn't even close to as good without Taco Fall. This defense was elite, you know, top five in the country defensive efficiency-wise with Taco Fall. Without him, the numbers are way down defensively. I think when I looked before last game, without him, they were around 110th in defensive efficiency. Now, last game, their defense looked really good against SMU. But SMU is just a shell of their former self. You know, they've got some serious injury problems. So I think this gives us a decent chance to look to go back against UCF because, you know, the public perception would be UCF's back. You know, look at that game against SMU. I think that's a little bit dangerous to think right now.
Yeah, and it's a big thing. And that's why box score study is so important is that, you know, you kind of got to look at these games and say, okay, is this more bad defense or is this more good defense or more bad offense? And then also, as you mentioned, I think SMU's got what? Five or six scholarship players that are playing for them right now because of all the injuries that they have going on. You know, I mean, they had only 43 field goal attempts in this game and two players combined for 22 of them. So you know, they just don't have anybody to spread the ball around to right now. Now, if UCF plays well defensively against Tulsa here coming up, yeah, then maybe you start to look at it in a little bit different of a light. But, you know, like you said, I mean, SMU is just not what they used to be. And that's important. And that's something that we haven't talked about as much in college basketball as we do in college football. And maybe this is something that we can do for the Wednesday recording that we're going to do. I'll go ahead and throw that surprise out there for our listeners. Now that Friday's show will be Kyle Hunter and I for about 45 minutes or so talking just college basketball. That'll be coming up on Friday with one of those studio quality recordings. But you know, this is something that maybe we can revisit here on that Wednesday recording is that, you know, when we talk about college football, we talk about constantly reevaluating the wins that a team has. You need to be reevaluating some of the wins and some of the performances that a team has throughout the course of the college basketball season. And for UCF, if they beat SMU 4 or 5 weeks ago like that, that's really impressive. But doing it now, not so much.
Yeah, you're right. Right now, that doesn't mean nearly as much. You know, this SMU team, it's really hard. You know, they haven't even been able to practice several of the games just because too many people were injured. If you're not even able to practice because everybody's hurt, I know at one point Tim Yankovich said, you know, we didn't even have five guys who were healthy enough to practice. So that's a really hard spot. And SMU, you know, it's hard to line SMU games right now. And I'll say that, you know, probably would have been a good move to go against SMU in hindsight. But, you know, it's tough because, you know, the odds makers have adjusted it. And you think that maybe you're not getting enough value, but it's really hard to quantify, you know, how much to devalue a team based on that situation. I will say, though, based on what we've seen from SMU, that game against Cincinnati at home where they were just absolutely blown out. And, you know, I will say Cincinnati had a rough week this week. Actually, the Ohio teams in general had a rough week. Cincinnati, Ohio State, and then Xavier lost a big game as well. You know, but Cincinnati was a team that we talked about was probably not as good as their record indicated. They had a rough week this week. But, you know, Cincinnati is one of those teams that's been able to run up the score on some bad teams. But now against the best teams, they haven't looked as good. UCF with three straight covers here, they're playing in a really weak league. But they do have a couple tricky spots coming up. I think that I would look to go against UCF.
All right, so how about a team to buy low? What are you looking for here?
St. Mary's here, three straight ATS losses. You know, St. Mary's, you know, everybody assumes that they're probably in the bracket. But they have to be careful. You know, they can't afford missteps. When you're playing in the West Coast Conference and it's as weak as it is right now, you know, it's really St. Mary's and Gonzaga. BYU is a decent team. They're not as good as they were a couple of years ago. St. Mary's can't trip up now. So I think St. Mary's, three straight ACS losses, and they're a really well-coached team. This is a team that Randy Bennett's a tremendous coach. This is a team that every single year is at least as good as expectations, it seems to me. And they always play good basketball in the month of March. I think St. Mary's is a team that could finish the season out strong. You know, their matchups here in the last couple games, they play against Pepperdine and against Santa Clara. They're going to be big favorites in those games. Now, St. Mary's has been pretty good at blowing out these bad teams. They beat Santa Clara by 24 in the first game. They beat Pepperdine by 24. Both of those were on the road. I wouldn't necessarily say that I'd love to lay, you know, the 20 points they're going to have to be laying in these games. But I think when you get in the West Coast Conference Tournament, so this is more of a longer look for me with St. Mary's. The other one was both short and long term for UCF. But St. Mary's is a team that I think probably is a little bit undervalued now based on the fact that they've lost three straight ACS. And they really have to keep playing well. You know, this is not a team that can go out and you know, bow out really early in the conference tournament or they're going to be in trouble.
So St. Mary's is 100-1 at Five Dimes, 66-1 at BetOnline. Is that a price you're interested in at all or no?
I don't think so. I think St. Mary's, you know, Landale is a really good player. The rest of the team's not good enough when they play really athletic teams. And Gonzaga, I was surprised Gonzaga beat them the way they did at St. Mary's, but I think they kind of showed the blueprint. And, you know, to me, St. Mary's is a team that when they go up against somebody really athletic in the NCAA tournament, they're going to go against teams that are a lot better than what they've been playing here in West Coast Conference. And I think it's too big of a jump up.
All right. So as I mentioned, we're going to be doing another recording here on Wednesday. So we'll look ahead to some of the weekend games that are coming up Friday, Saturday, Sunday for our Friday edition of Bang the Book Radio. But we've got a few games to touch on here. We'll do this pretty quickly. Indiana and Nebraska, the first one you're looking at here.
Yeah, Nebraska, you know, Nebraska's right on the bubble. And we talked about Nebraska. I'm a little bit surprised that they've done as well as they have ATS lately. One thing that's interesting to me is consistently here we've seen Nebraska, you know, their price has been bet down. People have been betting against Nebraska every single game here lately. It's interesting because, you know, apparently other people were thinking the way that I was and looking to go against Nebraska. But every game, then when I see what the line is, I'm like, I can't go against Nebraska. So, you know, I haven't bet against Nebraska yet because I didn't think the price was good enough. I'm curious to see what we see here in these last couple games because they play, I would say, a couple tricky games. You know, home against Indiana here that we're talking about, and then home against Penn State. Penn State's obviously playing really well. Indiana's playing better than most people realize at this point. Indiana has won their last four games. I realize they haven't played good teams in that stretch. But still, you know, you win by 22 points at Rutgers. They win at Iowa, which can be a tricky place to play. Indiana's third best in the Big Ten in defensive efficiency so far this year. Archie Miller is doing a pretty good job with his team here late in the season. You know, Miller's a good coach, and we knew that ahead of time. And they started out worse than people thought. I think Indiana's a tricky team right now, so I'm curious to see what this number comes out at. Nebraska's not a team that I like to lay points with very much. As I talked about before, I think that Nebraska's a lot better underdog because their defense is good, other than their defensive rebounding problem. They're worse than the Big Ten in defensive rebounding, and you know, that could really hurt them either this week or in the Big Ten conference tournament. But Nebraska isn't a great off either. You know, they're a team that plays really hard. I think Tim Miles does a good job getting a lot out of his team. But I imagine they'll probably be favored by 3 points, somewhere in that range against Indiana. I think that's going to be a tricky one because I think this is going to be a really close game that goes down to the wire. So I don't have any really strong lean in this game. I might lean a little bit to Indiana, especially if the price was a little higher than that. I think this could be a little bit lower scoring game than people would expect. So I'll have a slight lean to the under as well. But to me, this is just one of those big showcase games where, you know, let's see what Nebraska's made of because they have to win this game.
An angle that I do like to play is after a team has a winning streak snapped, I do like to fade them that second game. Nebraska had won 6 in a row, lost on the road at Illinois by 6. I'd like to look to play against them in this spot because you get into a rhythm when you're winning games and you're feeling really good about yourself. Then you lose, and it kind of pops that balloon a little bit, so to speak. So I may be looking to go against Nebraska on that angle. I've had success with it in the NHL before, and I think it's something you can play in the NBA as well. Haven't really back-tested it too much in college because, you know, sometimes you just get teams that are just so much better than other teams, but that may be one that I'm looking at to play tomorrow night. All right, how about VCU and UMass? This is a pretty interesting matchup.
Yeah, I would say that this one is the closest to a premium look ahead here this week. Haven't gotten too deep on the card ahead this week, so I'm not sure if this one will make the cut or not. But I like the over at least some in this game. UMass is playing some terrible defense right now. Some of the worst defense in the country in conference play. 1.16 points per possession. They're shooting the ball a lot better than they had been. So UMass has had some really high-scoring games here of late. I think this total is going to be somewhere around 150. VCU likes to run. VCU burned me with my free pick on Saturday because they couldn't score against George Washington. But in general, VCU can usually score enough because they're pushing the tempo so much. I think the total will be around 150. I like the over some here. Like I said, I'll take a closer look at this one later. But UMass, to me, you know, they had a bunch of low-scoring games early in the season. And now they've had 7 straight games that have finished 151 or higher. I know one of those games went into overtime, but the rest were just high-scoring games. Neither of these teams have anything to play for. I don't see why either of these teams would be up for this game. So this would fit the overs have more value late in the season when those two teams haven't been very good theory. And I think that, you know, VCU going to be pushing the tempo. UMass playing quicker than they were early in the season. They're playing such bad defense. I like to look to play overs with teams that have been a low-scoring team earlier in the season, and it's kind of hard for odds makers to adjust upward later in the season because they've been so low. I think UMass fits that mold.
All right, let's transition to a game where both teams have a lot to play for. This is part of that bubble watch discussion we had earlier, except both of them pretty much on the bubble. Texas and Kansas State, what's the story here?
Yeah, you know, this is one where they're part of the Big 12, which is just completely wild. You know, I think the Big 12 is really, really deep league. I don't think anybody in the Big 12 is tremendous. Kansas isn't as good as they've been in the past. Texas Tech's a really good team, I think primarily because they're really well coached. But the Big 12's wide open. Kansas State won at Texas 67-64. That was a big win for them. This is road revenge chance. But Texas's record isn't really all that impressive, but they played a really tough schedule. And then Kansas State, they have a pretty good record, but their really weak non-conference schedule is hurting them. So to me, both of these teams have to win this game. You know, this is one of those spots where, you know, it's, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a must-win, but both of these teams need to win at this point. They're firmly on the bubble. You know, I don't feel like either one of these teams should feel very safe at all where they are right now. To me, you know, this, again, would be an under-lean for me because there would be plenty of reasons for both of these teams to be up for this game. And Kansas State, I will point out that, you know, for a long time in the middle of the season, Kansas State was not playing very good defense. When Stokes plays for Kansas State, they're a lot better on defense than they are when he's not in there. I think he's their best defender. He's been healthy of late, and that's made their defense better.
One more game to talk about here, and these are the types of games that we love to discuss. Pace War, Old Dominion, Marshall, big-time Conference USA matchup here.
Yeah, I like games like this a lot, as I've listened to this show now already, probably. Old Dominion wants to go slower. Marshall, really fast, you know, top 10 in the country in tempo. Marshall's a little bit better on defense than they've been in past years, which has made their overs have less value. They're not quite as efficient on offense as they used to be either. I think it's really surprising that Old Dominion's first in the Conference USA in offensive efficiency. You know, in the past, Old Dominion's had to win games, you know, 52-50. And they've won some games by large margins here of late, but 82-33 win and then putting up triple digits. I'm impressed with Old Dominion. I think that they could be a dangerous team in Conference USA. Marshall is a tricky matchup, though. I mean, they just, the way they play, it's not very easy for a team like Old Dominion. It really is not very easy to go to Marshall and win in general for anyone. And I think this would be a really close game. I know both of these teams have played, they've played some really spirited games against each other in recent years, and I don't have any reason to believe that this would be anything but a really close game again this year.
Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. What's going on over at the website right now, man?
Well, gearing up for March Madness, obviously. And this week I'm starting to have a special where you can go ahead and buy a kind of a March Madness early access package. It's $275 for the rest of the season. 48-26 in my last 74 college basketball plays. On the year, 58% on college basketball plays. It's been a really good year for me so far in college basketball. We'll look to try to finish it out strong. So if you're interested in that one, you can contact me at KyleHunterPicks on Twitter or Kyle@huntersportspicks.com. And then also that free pick newsletter, 66-33 in the last 99 free picks. You can sign up for that from huntersportspicks.com.
Kyle, appreciate your time, man. I'll talk to you again on Wednesday night for Friday's show.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, man.
Good stuff there on today's show with Kyle Hunter from huntersportspicks.com. Coming up on our Tuesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll have Brian Blessing, from the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. We'll also chat with Tony George from Doc Sports. Wednesday, Brian Leonard and Wes Reynolds. Thursday, Brad Powers and Rolf Michaels. Hopefully he'll be able to join us on the show again this week. And then Friday, as I mentioned, that studio quality recording with Kyle Hunter that we'll record on Wednesday night. Preview some games here coming up this weekend. Talk about a few of the other important betting concepts on that. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.